Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Vita. We're being joined at the open of the hour by my friend Dr. Greg Popchek, who joins us every week to talk about marriage and the family, application of the scriptures, theology of the body. And today's topic is something that resonates very dearly with my own heart. Although, if I'm being very honest, everything Greg and I talk about resonates deeply with me personally. And today's topic has to do with couples praying together. Well, actually, I want to step back. Personal prayer in general, and then prayer within the family, and the wisdom that I've gleaned from the work of Greg and Lisa Popchek have to do with cultivating a couple's prayer life. Greg and Lisa were the ones who very matter-of-factly taught my bride and I that praying as a couple doesn't have to be an intricate, extremely drawn-out thing. It's a work of intimacy. All prayer is about developing intimacy, primarily with God. And so when I pray with my bride, I am called to develop deeper spiritual intimacy with God and with her, so that both of us can ascend to God together. And so that's the wisdom that we will be talking about today. There's an abbreviation, an acronym, that Greg and Lisa have put forth in the past called PRAISE, P-R-A-S-E. And I'll ask Greg to touch on that in a little bit, but if not, we will have it in the description of today's program about how to develop in personal prayer and in the family, personal prayer within the family. We go on from there to speak with Joe Truesman. Since the beginning of Israel's military campaign against Iran's nuclear and military infrastructure, the Israeli military has targeted and eliminated key figures belonging to the Islamic Republic's military apparatus. And we need to talk about that. We need to talk about the military strategy that's at play here and what we ought to know, what we don't know, and what we can anticipate moving forward in terms of this conflict. And then finally, we speak with Dr. Leroy Huizinga. Each gospel reveals unique truths about who Jesus is. The Gospel of Matthew is particular about Jesus being the Messiah, Emmanuel, the heir to the throne of David. And so Leroy's new book, Behold the Christ, published by Emmaus Academic, touches on this. We talk about all of this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, June 17th. It's the Feast of St. Albert Chmielowski. Today's news brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. Cardinal Raymond Burke has asked Pope Leo to remove restrictions on the celebration of the traditional Latin Mass. Burke, speaking recently at a conference organized by the Latin Mass Society of England and Wales, telling attendees that he hopes the new pontiff will put an end to the persecution of the Catholic faithful who want to celebrate Mass using more ancient usage of the Roman liturgy. The White House is reportedly considering an offensive strike against Iran. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says he spoke to President Trump last night about the Israel-Iran conflict.
He will, at the end of the day, help Israel finish the job, and that will require, I think, weapons that Israel doesn't possess and maybe joint military operations.
Fox News reports that Trump administration official confirms that a strike is on the table. The report comes after President Trump said he wanted an unconditional surrender from Iran. Meanwhile, the U.S. is warning Americans about going to the Middle East.
Not to travel to Israel or Iraq, and not to travel to Iran under any circumstances.
The warning comes after a Fox News report that the White House is now considering an offensive strike against Iran. State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce said the Israel-Iran conflict is a rapidly evolving situation. Bruce said the State Department has set up a task force to help U.S. citizens in the Middle East stay informed. She again reiterated President Trump has said time and time again Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. I'm Lisa Taylor.
And thousands of White Sox fans came to the ballpark to hear Pope Leo preaching peace in a live-streamed address at Wright Field over the weekend. The event was hosted by the Archdiocese of Chicago, with Cardinal Blaise Cupich celebrating Mass. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. A deacon in charge of seminary formation recently told Greg Popchak that we no longer assume Catholics know how to pray, including applicants to the seminary. They know how to say prayers, but they have no personal prayer life. Greg joins us with some simple steps to starting personal prayer. Greg is no stranger to this program. He's the founder, executive director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute and CatholicCounselors.com. He is also, with his bride Lisa, one of the co-hosts of More to Life, co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN, and the producers of the Catholic HOM, Catholic Home App, helping Catholic families thrive. Greg, always a joy to speak with you. How are you?
I'm doing well. Great to be here, Marcus. Thank you.
It's always good to reconnect with you. And I want to start by asking if you could go through, if you recall some time ago, this is how my bride and I learned it, you created this acronym PRAISE for developing a personal prayer life. If I may ask you to walk through that for our listeners.
Of course. Yeah, PRAISE. P is for praise and thanksgiving, where we just kind of start by acknowledging the good things that God has done in our lives and all the good that God is, you know. So that's the difference. Thanksgiving is when we thank God for specific things. Praise is when we acknowledge His qualities. R is repentance, and that's not, and we're talking about, you know, couple and family prayer. So when we say repentance, it doesn't mean, you know, full scale confession. It's just, you know, Lord, I'm really sorry for that time that I, you know, maybe spoke unkindly to my wife or was a little less than patient with my kids. You know, help me to do better tomorrow, that kind of thing. A is ask for your needs, and we're all pretty good at that, but just basically, you know, asking God for whatever our concerns are.
Yeah.
I is interceding for others. S is seeking His will. So we have big questions that we're wrestling with that we want to kind of reflect on that you know, aren't just for a kind of a one-off sort of a prayer, but really more of something that we want to take to prayer daily until we can really clarify what God's will for our lives is. And then E stands for, end while promising to listen. Basically, recognizing that prayer doesn't end when we say amen, but that God continues the conversation with us because He speaks through experience, right? And so what I want to be able to do, because He speaks and things come into being, so I want to be able to listen to Him in the things that happen to me through the day and really be asking myself, what's the Holy Spirit saying to me through the events of the day, so that when we get back together to pray, I can maybe share a little bit about that.
Can I ask you to comment, just based on your experience and insight, why do you think it is that we as a Catholic community, especially amongst lay people, on the one hand presume that every Catholic knows how to pray, but on the other hand, many don't?
Yeah, and that's a difficult one for me to answer. I mean, honestly, because I was raised in a way that really emphasized personal prayer as well as formal prayer. And my understanding was always that, you know, we begin with that personal relationship with God, but then the formal prayers of the church help us to deepen that prayer life and teach us to, for example, pray about things that we would never think of praying about. For example, a happy death, or that God would forgive us of this or that, or, you know, really all the things, or reflecting on the life of Christ, for example, in the rosary. You know, I might be, you know, happy to talk about all my concerns and worries and frustrations with God, but to think about those deeper things, it requires a structure, and that's what the formal prayers of the church enable us to do, to take that personal prayer life and go deeper with it. But I think that Catholics have learned that those formal prayers are to stand in place of a personal relationship in some way. And I think that's well-intentioned. I think, you know, people want to pray, and so this is how we learn to pray, and so we say those things.
Right.
But I think, in effect, it's a little bit like, you know, if my wife asked me, "Hey, Greg, do you love me?" And I said, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely, and more, you know, and more temperate." Or, you know, if my kid asked me to play with him, I said, "Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and I took the road less." You know, I mean, it's okay, but it misses the point, right? So I think we've learned as Catholics that to pray means to say certain formulaic things that are really beautiful and efficacious, and also meant to take our prayer life deeper. But we mistake that for a personal prayer life. And that's what that seminary formator was talking to us about.
It's funny because I've used both those poems practically in both those ways.
Yeah.
Now,
Oh, Marcus.
You know
we'll
me well.
Later.
So let's talk about the fact that that language of intimacy, Greg, for a lot of our listeners right now, it's a trepidatious struggle to even want to think about approaching personal prayer. So knowing that acronym provides a framework and a structure, but can you help us with a kind of mindset, a kind of emotional approach, if you will?
Yeah, and this is something that I always did intuitively, but I never really knew how to explain it until I read an interview with a spiritual writer, Sarah Clarkson. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about her struggle with her personal prayer life with her spiritual director. And the spiritual director suggested something that I thought was really quite profound. He said, all that self-talk that you do, all those thoughts that go through your head all day long, mm-hmm. put Lord in front of them and make it into a prayer. So, you know, you wake up in the morning like, I feel grungy and I don't like that. I'm grumpy about the day. And I say, Lord, I just feel gross and I'm grungy and I don't want to spend. I'm miserable about the day. Can you please help me? It's looking beautiful sun. Lord, thank you for that beautiful sunrise. You just stick Lord in front of those self-talk and those thoughts in your head. And all of a sudden you've got a constant ongoing dialogue with God going on. That's personal prayer. You know, we're having all these words go through our head all day. Why don't we just give them to God? I mean, that's really what 2 Corinthians 10:5 is all about, where it talks about, testing every thought and making it obedient to Christ.
Right.
So instead of just keeping those thoughts to ourselves, let's keep up that running dialogue with God. And it allows us to kind of be everyday active mystics, in a sense, where we're just bringing all of our thoughts and concerns and feelings and experiences to God in that constant discussion throughout the day. And all of a sudden, I've got this deep, rich, quasi-mystical prayer life.
And once again, you're reminding us that family prayer life, prayer life for the laity, shouldn't look like the cloistered monastic model of prayer.
No, it shouldn't. And that's another thing altogether. But I do think that even there, right, for example, that seminary formator who was telling us, that Catholics, they don't assume that Catholics pray anymore, including seminarians. You know, even the monastic prayer life has to begin with personal prayer.
Right.
Right. So the presumption there is that this person who's entering the monastery has a deep and personal relationship with Christ, who wants to take it even deeper using these other forms of prayer and this monastic rule of life. But it doesn't stand in the place of that. And so, even there, it all begins with that personal running dialogue with the Lord that we should be having all the time, that then the formal prayers help us to take deeper.
Yeah. And this language of having a personal relationship sounds like you're trying to make Jesus your buddy, so to speak. But in a real sense, this is what it's about. It's intimacy, it's friendship, it's constant dialogue. That's how you build a personal relationship.
Yeah, I mean, we don't ever forget who Jesus is. I mean, he is our Savior. He is our Redeemer. He is our King. He is all of that.
Yeah.
But he also says that he wants to be friend.
Right.
No longer slaves. I call you friend. That's what Jesus said. So, sure, it's kind of, kind of derogatory to think of Jesus as a buddy and something,
but
he's presented himself as a friend, as someone who we can bring everything to and who wants to know us inside and out and doesn't want anything to be kept from him. And so this idea of using that kind of self-talk as a prayer, I think, is a really profound and simple way to begin to get a toe in the water of that kind of meaningful, intimate, personal prayer life that allows God into all the parts of yourself that maybe you've been keeping him out of, because they aren't covered by formal prayers and they're not pretty to look at.
Okay, so we've talked about those interior dialogues. What about for parents listening right now who want to take the first step in building a kind of family prayer liturgy?
Well, I think that that acronym PRAISE is something that we really like to kind of teach families, because it allows us to kind of have a framework, but still bring our own thoughts and our own feelings to the thing. So as a family, gathering around, you want to start. And this is a great way, by the way, to teach individual prayer. You sit as a family and you go through that acronym one at a time and just ask questions. Okay, what do you want to thank God for today? What do you want to ask his help with? And go through the whole thing.
Greg, always.
And we talk about this more on Catholic Home. Sorry, I mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, you're good.
This is exactly what we do on the Catholic Home app at Catholic HOM.
My guest has been Dr. Gregory Popchick, founder and executive director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute, and he and his bride have founded the Catholic HOM app. Check it out. It'll help your family thrive. I'm Marcus Peter.
Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic help, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
You can hear Ave Maria Radio from your home computer or your smartphone, where you can access Ave Maria Radio from anywhere in the world, regardless of the time of day. All you need to do is download the Ave Maria Radio app from the App Store, Google Play, or Galaxy Stores. You never have to lose signal. You never have to miss your favorite program ever again. It's what you want and how you want it. And with the Ave Maria Radio archives, it's available when you want it most. The Ave Maria Radio app, heard where radios aren't available.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mark Spita.
Since the beginning of Israel's military campaign against Iran's nuclear and military infrastructure, the Israeli military has targeted and eliminated key figures belonging to the Islamic Republic's military apparatus. Joe Trusman has the latest. Joe is senior research analyst for the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he edits the FDD's Long War Journal, and you can visit his work, fdd.org. Joe, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Hi, pleasure to be here. I'm doing well.
Well, given everything we already know from the present mainstream media about what's going on in this new conflict between Israel and Iran, or at least the new stage of the new phase of the conflict, let us know what we know today. What's the most recent about eliminating senior Iranian military officials?
Correct. So, as we've heard over the last few days, of course, Israel has carried out airstrikes against not only Iran's nuclear facilities, but also they've targeted the Iran's military bases and security apparatus, specifically its military leadership. So far, they've taken out key leaders of Iran's military apparatus, including, this happened earlier today at least, one of the replacements, or rather who took over, one of the generals that was killed in the beginning stages of the war, in the beginning hours of the conflict. So I think right now what we're seeing, what we're observing right now, as far as the elimination of key leaders of Iran's military apparatus, is that Israel is demonstrating that it has the intelligence capability, all right, a deep intelligence capability to track these leaders, and they're demonstrating it, and it's definitely a problem for Tehran.
And tell us about how the operation began, the precision airstrikes, and like you mentioned, Israel is showing once again its very clear, intelligent, strategic approach to conflict. They're not just going in guns a-blazing without any order.
Right. I think this is very similar to what we observed last year mm-hmm. when Israel and Hezbollah were in conflict. I think it's taken many, many years of intelligence gathering by the Israelis, a lot of hard work, and one can say some luck, too, for the Israelis to, what appears to be at least, from what I am assessing, from what I'm seeing, is a very successful opening days or opening operations against the Islamic Republic of Iran, specifically its military leadership. But this is purely, I think this is intelligence gathering at its finest, and they're Israelis are able to track these guys, these military leaders, and at their apartments, at bases, at underground compounds, and strike them and eliminate them.
We're not seeing similar precision, calculatedness, or even nuanced strategy from the Iranian side, though.
Correct, and I think this is what we're. I think this demonstrates as well that the Iranians were. I think they were caught off guard.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I think they were very surprised about this, and they, of course, it goes back to the opening strikes that I mentioned. Removing these leaders very likely caused chaos within the military hierarchy of the Iranian armed forces. So now, what we've been observing over the last days is drones and ballistic missiles fired at Israeli territory, which is something I think most analysts and the Israelis, of course, anticipated. But we're not seeing the broader axis or the Iran-led axis of what it's called the axis of resistance, mm-hmm. which is made up of proxies. We're not seeing a lot from them, which is a little surprising, but we are seeing some activity from the Houthis in Yemen that have fired at least one or two ballistic missiles at Israel in coordination with Iran.
How much of an impact was the assassination of Ali Shatmani on Iran's military directedness and in terms of its military might and authority?
Right. I think, and I touched on it a little. I think the almost decapitation of many of the heads of the leaders of these armed forces, like Shamdani, for example, caused chaos. And but we're seeing it. You know, it took some time for the Iranians to respond. I will say, though, I think as well, which is important, I think the Israelis also understood that the Iranians would attempt to fire ballistic missiles mm-hmm. or drones or other munitions in a quick manner if an opening strike occurred by the Israelis. And the IDF demonstrated that they went after launchers. They went after the ballistic missile silos at the beginning as well to cut off that response from the Iranians. So I think that helped too here. But at the end of the day, I think, again, the elimination of Shamdani and others, Salami, for example, too, caused chaos in the upper echelons of its military apparatus. And we saw the results. But now, over the last couple of days, we're seeing the Iranians firing ballistic missiles, of course, and drones, and causing damage to the Israeli home front.
As it pertains to launch capacity and ballistics capacity, like you mentioned, Israel targeted launch sites and wherever ballistic missiles were stored and with the capacity of launching toward Israel. How much of that has mm-hmm. already been crippled by Israel?
Correct. And I think, you know, I've observed some estimates. I've observed a quarter of it. I've observed up to 40%.
Numbers.
Those are very, very high numbers, which is actually very good, because we have to remember that as of now, the primary means for Iran to attack the Israeli home front mm-hmm. are the ballistic missiles and the drones. Those are the two things, especially the ballistic missiles. And if Israel can cut that off or at least degrade it severely, I think it'll save lives on the Israeli home front.
The language here, amongst others, about Operation Rising Lion is that Israel is attempting to preempt Iran's nuclear ambitions. It wants to rein in some of the Quds force. How much of that are we seeing being successful?
Right, and that's the million-dollar question. I think right now, you know, we see everything that's on the television. We're reading everything,
yeah.
you know, that's happening, and the Israeli success that it's had against, you know, as we mentioned, eliminating Iranian leaders, for example, military officials. But I think none of that matters as much unless the Israelis are able to do one of two things. If they need to degrade or completely destroy Iran's nuclear facilities, so it cannot obtain a bomb or it cannot build a bomb, that's very important.
Yeah.
Or if they can force the Iranians or compel the Iranians to change their minds, get a deal done with the United States, and abandon its nuclear ambition.
Mm-hmm.
So one of those two things has to happen. If they don't, I mean, I could interpret this as a failure for the Israelis, to be quite honest with you.
Just earlier today, Reza Pahlavi, the eldest mm-hmm. son of Iran's last Shah, he put out a video statement that this is essentially the collapse of the Islamic Republic, and that he has plans from the point of taking over authority for the first 100 days of administration. I wonder if you could comment on that really briefly.
I would say that I think what he is trying to attempt here is he's trying to compel the Iranian people to rise up,
mm-hmm.
all right? Because I don't think it's in the Israelis' objective or their goals for regime change, all right? I don't think the Israelis
mm-hmm.
could actually achieve that just by military strikes, all right? Yes, you can say that these strikes are weakening the Iranian regime. However, I think the Shah is attempting to compel these ordinary Iranians to rise up and overthrow Khamenei.
Right, with a, he didn't use the word constitutional monarchy, but it seems like that's the lean. Joe, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
My guest, Joe Truesman, Senior Research Analyst for the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. We've been talking about this conflict in Israel and Iran. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Joseph's Helper's mission is not only to repair homes for those in need, but to repair hearts by providing companionship and peace of mind, especially for veterans and the elderly. But they cannot meet the great needs of our community without volunteers like you. If you have the skills to complete small 2-hour home repair projects, to help in our office, or to be a prayer minister, visit sjhelpers.org today to let us know your availability. That's sjhelpers.org. St. Joseph's Helpers, giving dignity, spreading hope.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes, without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
What does the Catholic Catechism teach about divorce? The Church does not permit divorce in a valid marriage because she is firmly adhering to the rules set down by her founder. Jesus Christ made it very clear that a sacramental valid marriage was not to be dissolved. Whoever divorces his wife, he declared, and marries another, commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Therefore, the Church maintains a second marriage cannot be recognized as valid if the first marriage is valid. The Catechism tells us if the divorced are remarried civilly, they find themselves in a situation that objectively contravenes God's law. In such a situation, they may not receive Eucharistic communion as long as this situation persists. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
We lived in a neighborhood for 13 years and knew few of our neighbors. Most stayed to themselves. Being very social people, this was odd for my family, but we accepted it. When we moved into a new neighborhood, we quickly got to know many neighbors. In less than a year, we knew more about our new neighbors than we ever did the old neighbors. However, there is one particular neighbor who seemed very unfriendly, but we waved to him anyway and we talked to him when possible. He's brief in his commentary, but we smile and wave. He once wrote a couple of terse post-it notes to my husband over something very silly, but we didn't allow it to change the way we treat him. We're still kind. How many of you know your neighbors? Knowing them, asking about them, is loving them. We're all called to love our neighbors, and we can communicate love of our neighbor by first getting to know them, and through our kindness, we can evangelize the faith. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communications evangelist and host of Epiphany.
No one should ever have to choose between feeding their family and keeping their heat on. Impossible questions like rent or diapers demand answers every day, likely in your very own neighborhood, but you can help. Hope Clinic partners with you to provide free medical, dental, food, and behavioral health care, all in Jesus' name. While others face impossible choices, your choice is an easy one. Partner with Hope Clinic today. Find out how at www.thehopeclinic.org.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Vita. Each of the Gospels invites you and I to deeply dive into the unique way in which they proclaim the same truth, who Jesus is. For Matthew, Jesus is Emmanuel, God with us always, who saves us from sin, and in doing so, Matthew gives us a way of reading the Scriptures according to both letter and the Spirit. We're joined by Leroy Huizinga, who is the author of Behold the Christ, Proclaiming the Gospel of Matthew. Leroy, it's great to speak with you. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
So, I'm greatly intrigued by the content of this book. I read it some time ago, and I greatly appreciate the thoughtfulness that went into the book. And you start by acknowledging our modern, very Gnostic tendencies. It's almost in the air that we breathe. And by virtue of that, that watered-down offshoot of Gnosticism, a moralistic therapeutic deism, I wonder if we can begin there for you to just define what these mean and how they seem to rear their ugly head in our faith today.
Certainly. So Gnosticism is a perennial, constant worldview that is found in all cultures throughout history. Mm-hmm. Basically, it denies the goodness of anything physical, anything material. And when you get into full-fledged Gnosticism, say in the Western context, Gnostic Judaism, Gnostic Christianity, basically, the world, the visible world, is seen as evil and often the product of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jewish or Christian Gnostics will read Genesis 1, 2, and 3 kind of backwards, whereas like God is the villain and the serpent figure is the hero. Now, with that sort of worldview, anything physical being evil, human bodies are evil. And so the point of salvation would be the liberation of the spirit from the body. Also, in some Gnostic circles, you would have extreme calorie restriction, doing as little with the body as possible, including eating. Sexual relations would be frowned upon in a lot of Gnostic circles. So Gnosticism basically thinks anything material, thus creation, mm-hmm. is evil, thus the creator God is evil. Shall I continue with moral therapeutic deism?
Yeah, actually. So from there, help us focus then the issue of this modern manifestation, moralistic therapeutic deism.
Sure. So Gnosticism is basically an escape, right, that seeks, you know, refuge in the self, mm-hmm. in the mind, in the spirit, and in our own day, feelings. It's an internal thing, right? The body doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you think the body doesn't matter, or if it's a problem, or if it's evil, somewhere on that spectrum, what do you have left? Well, you have your mind, you have your feelings, you have your thoughts. And so in our own day, religion has become what Christian Smith, who's a professor at Notre Dame, calls moral therapeutic deism. Religion is merely about moralism. I should be a good person. It's therapeutic. It should give me good feelings, right? We've been in therapeutic culture for decades now where everything's about feelings. And deism, D-E-I-S-M, is the idea that there's a God back where and when who kind of got everything up and running and then leaves it alone. So God doesn't really intervene in history or in the moment. He or it, better, is simply the force that set everything in motion, and now it kind of runs like a clock.
Right. And as you're defining this, I think all of our listeners finds it really easy to see how some semblance or even the entire gamut of that definition fits into how modern man thinks about religion in general. Now, if I may ask you then to help us take a good look at the scriptures, it's so easy for that same secularist Gnostic framework to superimpose that into a hermeneutic, a reading of the scriptures.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. And, you know, we're in an age where everybody, you know, has a Bible or 7 or 13 on their shelves. And, you know, Catholics, of course, you know, we're encouraged to read the Bible and we should. You know, of course, the difficulty is that is that you can come up with your own interpretations. You're often unaware of what you're bringing to the text. And you can often impose your own thoughts or feelings or desires, wants upon the text.
Right.
And, you know, one really good exercise to do is to look at someone's Bible, look at your own Bible, see what you've highlighted, see what you haven't. Why did you highlight this and not that? Right? That'll reveal, you know, where your emphases are, what you're bringing to the text. You know, so a lot of people think in terms of Gnosticism without even knowing it, moral therapeutic deism without even knowing it. And so they gravitate towards the parts of, say, the New Testament that are uplifting, that make them feel good. And, of course, there's a lot more stuff in the New Testament and in the broader Bible than that. You know, the Bible is much more than a rule book. I wouldn't want to say it's just a rule book. It's full of stories. It shapes our experience. But we've got to be open to what it actually has to say to us. And that's why I sometimes tell people that are kind of stuck, you know, go read Leviticus. Go read Haggai. You know, go read the little letter of Jude. You know, the stuff you don't spend time in.
So from there then, Leroy, like you mentioned, these obscure books, they form part of the grander narrative, and therefore that brings out one of the themes in the earlier part of the book, which is an intertextual reading of scriptures. Just briefly talk about what that means.
Sure. You know, so here I'm going to channel St. Augustine, St. Irenaeus a little bit. You know, so scripture presumes and presents a story, and that story is a story in four acts, creation, fall, redemption, and glory. And the act of redemption is most of the Bible, right? Three scenes in this third act of redemption, Israel, Jesus, and the church. So Israel's story culminates in Jesus, who was Jewish, who was the ideal Israelite. You get 12 tribes of Israel, thus 12 apostles. You have the sacrifices in the Old Testament temples, the first and then the second. Those are fulfilled by the sacrifice of the Eucharist. And, of course, Jesus then turns around and sends the church forth as a new Israel,
right?
And I often would, you know, tell my students or tell others, you know, if you ever wonder why, you know, Catholicism is weird, you know, and even, you know, the most normal suburban parish, right? You know, it's weird to people who aren't Catholic. Why do you have an all-male priesthood? You know, and they're wearing vestments. And, like, the simple act of kneeling or crossing oneself is really bizarre to people that aren't familiar with it. So I'd ask my students, you know, why do you think Catholicism is so weird? Well, it's because we're an Old Testament people. right? We've got an all-male priesthood who offers the sacrifice of the Eucharist, wearing vestments in churches that should look like temples, because in the Old Testament, there was an all-male priesthood offering sacrifices while wearing vestments in the first and then the second temple.
Right.
So the Old Testament flows into the New Testament, and the New Testament in a certain way never closed. I mean, the church is there in the New Testament, and it's the same church we belong to.
Now, considering that, we're running out of time in this segment, so when we pick up, Leroy, I want to ask that we then start talking about the Gospels as a particular kind of literature within the canon of Scriptures. They form the very heart of divine revelation, or at least biblical revelation as we have it. I'm talking with Dr. Leroy Huizinga. He is Administrative Chair of Arts and Letters and Associate Professor of Theology at the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota. He is also the author of Behold the Christ, Proclaiming the Gospel of Matthew. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Join Bishop Earl Boyer and clergy from around the diocese June 21st at 10 a.m. for a Mass at the Lansing Lugnuts Ballpark and a Eucharistic processions to the steps of the state capitol. There will be an opportunity to receive the indulgence for the Jubilee year. Just RSVP at EucharisticJourney.org to let them know that you'll be joining Bishop Boyer for this opportunity to be Christ's witnesses to the world that is longing for the fulfillment that only can come from Him. That's EucharisticJourney.org.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Light of the East. Weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, artificial flowers, artificial flavors, artificial birth control, and now it's artificial intelligence, known as AI. Is there any place anymore where things are real and natural? One place to look is the Eastern Catholic Churches.
Now on Ave Maria Radio's newest FM stations, 105.5 FM in Southfield and 107.9 FM in Ann Arbor.
This week on Christ is the Answer, we begin Father John's series on the Ten Commandments. After freeing the Hebrews from slavery in Egypt, the Lord gave Moses the new rule to which the people of God would abide as part of the new covenant. The most recognizable of these rules are the Ten Commandments. Join us this week as Father John expounds on the first and second commandments and asks the question, why be good? Tune in for Christ is the Answer, Monday through Fridays at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them. So you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200. Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm speaking with Dr. Leroy Huizinga, Administrative Chair of Arts and Letters and Associate Professor of Theology at the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota. We're talking about his book, Behold the Christ, Proclaiming the Gospel of Matthew. So, Leroy, when we left off, we had just started talking about the Gospels being a kind of revelationary heartbeat in the canon of the Scriptures. Can we pick up from there?
Yes, we can certainly pick up from there. So the Gospels are the center of the Christian canon.
Mm-hmm.
They're directly about Jesus, who is God on earth, and thus God's direct revelation to creation and humanity. And so this is, you know, it's a simple, understandable example. I mean, this is why we stand for the reading of the Gospel in the liturgy, right? But, you know, generally sit for the other readings. You know, we stand for the Gospel because it's about Jesus. So when you're reading the New Testament in particular, right, the Gospel should have pride of place. And then it's like Paul's letters and the other letters are reflections on the content of the Gospels. So the Gospels have this priority there. They are the lens through which the entire Bible, Genesis to Revelation, is interpreted. They are that to which the Old Testament points fundamentally, right, and to which the rest of the New Testament looks back.
Now, considering that, without overplaying this hand then, one of the ways in which scholars view the Gospel of Matthew in a particular way is by appreciating the sheer Jewishness of the book, the Jewish heritage of Matthew. Could you please shed some light on why that Hebrew tradition becomes so crucial for the theological foundations for what Matthew is trying to teach us?
Certainly, and, you know, I think we all need to understand that every New Testament document is a Jewish document because Christianity is fundamentally Jewish, you know, Jesus being the Jewish Christ and all. All the authors are Jews.
Mm-hmm.
St. Luke was possibly a Gentile that converted to Judaism. So every document is Jewish. When it comes to the Gospel of Matthew, I think we feel that in a particular way, because it's firmly in the world of Pharisaic Judaism, which becomes Rabbinic Judaism,
right,
which becomes kind of, if you will, you know, the hardcore Judaism that, you know, the world is familiar with today. You know, Jews who dress a certain way, who do all the rituals, keep the law. That's the world in which Matthew is set. That's the world he presents.
Yeah.
And another way of putting it is that Matthew's gospel probably emphasizes Jesus' own fidelity to the Jewish law above and beyond the other gospels. They do the same, but Matthew really emphasizes it as if to say, you know, Jesus was a better Jew than the Pharisees who are opposing him.
Right. And so because of that, then, when we're reading the narrative, there's a particular literary genre at play here. There's a, like you rightly mentioned, it's a story, there's a Matthean story involved from a particular perspective. And having that lens, having that hermeneutic, presents us with a way to glean what Matthew is truly trying to get at.
This is correct. So, you know, a lot of people have favorite verses or passages from the Bible, from the Gospels, and that's, you know, fine. It's not sufficient because the Gospels are fundamentally stories. They're not just collections of sayings, right? They have a beginning, middle, and end. They have plots. They have characters.
Yeah.
They have conflict and resolution, all the stuff we, you know, learned back in, I suppose, seventh grade literature. And in Matthew's story, it's interesting because out of the gate, Jesus indicates that his mission is only for Israel.
Mm.
But then he encounters more and more opposition. And by the time you get to the end of the gospel, Jesus' mission, it turns out, is for the entire world.
Right.
But at the same time, Matthew, as the author, is including very early on quotes from Isaiah pointing to good things coming to the Gentiles. And even the way the stories are told in Matthew 2, right, the visit of the Magi. I mean, you know, those are probably Nabataean Arabs who would be at that point pagans, and they are astrologers. You know, you've got these, you know, non-Jewish pagan astrologers seeking out the Christ child. I mean, that's a hint that Jesus is for the world, not yeah. just the Jews. But then you get into, like, Matthew 10, and Jesus says, you know, go only to the houses of Israel. You know, don't go among the Gentiles, the pagans. You know, I think chapter 15, mm-hmm. you know, the woman with the demonized daughter, oh, help me. And he says, I was only, you know, sent to help the children of Israel.
Right.
But all that conflict, eventually it breaks, you know, open in the world of the story. And Jesus, at the end of the gospel, says, make disciples of all nations, right? All peoples, all Gentiles, all pagans, and baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit.
So you present here this amazing, and frankly for the Jews at that time, almost jarring and scandalous reality that the Jesus, the Christ, is here. He's for the Jews, but he's also for the Gentiles and for the whole world. And so you've got this interplay here between Matthew's genealogy showing Jesus as the heir to the Davidic throne, the rightful heir to the Davidic throne, but at the same time also Emmanuel, really God with all of us, not just God for Israel.
Yeah, I think that's correct. You know, the genealogy, I mean, modern people, we hear that, and it's, you know, we hear it in English, but those are Semitic names, mm-hmm. and our eyes kind of glaze over. I forget where it is on the lectionary, but there is a day when, you know, the gospel reading is the genealogy, and the poor lector that day, that, you know, or the poor deacon or priest that day that has to read it, right? But every name in that genealogy is important,
yeah.
and is an incipient story. You know, there's something attached there that Matthew wants us to know.
Right.
You know, and you can dig in and look up every single name and look at the whole chain and see a lot of interesting things going on there. Certainly the inclusion of Gentiles is foreshadowed there. You know, there's, you know, four or five women in that genealogy who are involved in what I think I call in the book irregular sexual situations. Kind of foreshadowing that God works through weird situations.
Yeah.
So maybe people shouldn't be surprised that he worked through the Blessed Virgin Mary, you know, in this sort of betrothal to Joseph,
uh-huh.
you know, by the power of the Spirit. You know, so Matthew with that genealogy is doing quite a lot beyond just saying, oh yeah, Jesus is, you know, in the Davidic line.
Right.
A lot more going on.
So from there, then, if we take a step back and look at the grander narrative, he's appealing to so much, even from the genealogy. And so we get this concept of Christ eventually becomes clear, is establishing a new and eternal covenant, which connotes a new and eternal covenant family in the church, which will become the new Israel, this full flourishing of Israel. And it begets, or it is created with, a new and eternal Eucharistic thanksgiving sacrifice that's inherent to the identity of its covenant life.
Yeah, I mean, the Eucharist is the center of everything for everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in Matthew, the Last Supper, the Eucharist, it's definitely a Passover meal. I mean, it's Jewish in ethos. Jesus takes the Passover, interprets it, and makes it, shall we say, his own ritual for the church. But it's fundamentally, you know, Jewish in character. It's mm-hmm. born out of the Passover. But then it is a sacrifice, and other peoples and religions around the world, you know, have sacrifices. I mean, religion without sacrifice is incomprehensible
yep.
until the Protestant Reformation,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You know, the Greeks, the Romans had their sacrifices, you know, Muslims to this day, right, have a sacrifice.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a non-sacrificial religion. They've got a sacrifice, right? So other
even
early Jewish people can also find their own religion fulfilled in the Eucharist.
If I may just jump in for you to comment, even early versions of the Protestant revolt had a sacrificial undertone in their liturgical offerings. It was, you know, further devolution into low church Protestantism that practically did away with the sacrificial notion and element.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and it depends on, you know, which body within Protestantism. I mean, out of the gate, you know, some people like Zwingli were quite content to present the Lord's Supper as merely a memorial, you know, but in the Church of England, you know, it's unclear even to Catholics if this is a valid Eucharist until the 19th century. You know, Lutherans for a long time, you know, would use the term priest for their ministers. You know, it's in the American tradition that a lot of Protestantism becomes seriously anti-Catholic and seeks to be the opposite of Catholicism. But in European history, that's not always the case.
So if we have about a minute left, and just to round this off, as we approach Matthew, just with all the context that you've shared with us, and reading your book really gives that insight, what exhortation do you have to our listeners right now in approaching the first of these Gospels?
I would think if a person could shut the world out for about 2 or 3 hours and just read the thing straight through, you know, just with attention, like you're reading a story. Or if time doesn't permit that, you know, read nothing but it for the next 4 nights, you know, 30 minutes, 45 minutes a night, and read it through as a story and just see what you notice and let the Holy Spirit work through that sort of reading.
Leroy, it was a real joy to connect with you. Thank you for making the time.
Anytime. I appreciate being on.
My guest, Dr. Leroy Huizenga, Administrative Chair of Arts and Letters and Associate Professor of Theology at the University of Mary and author of Behold the Christ. Pick up the Gospel of Matthew. Read it. Let it transform you. I'm Marcus Peter.